time. The typical very well-managed enterprise has on the order of 1,500 to 2,500 applications in their portfolio. That's well-managed. The worst I've seen is in excess of 200,000 individual applications. Let's assume you're not one of those, and instead more towards the 1,500 line. If I do one every 3 months and start popping them out, I'm still waiting on the order of 500 years before I've modernized my application portfolio, which is really kind of not where I want to go. But before we begin, I do want to pause briefly for a word from our sponsor. Today's talk will be sponsored by Windows 8.
Years and years ago, in 2005, computers used to look like this. Back when I was 1 year old. Look at this thing! It weighs way more than me! With Windows 8, my surface looks this small! And it is so much more powerful! And it also features Android Integrity Control. That's one of UAC for all your non-hackers out there. It keeps me safe when people try to hack me. And then my credit card number is stolen 5 times! I wouldn't have a credit card! Now I'm protected by application isolation. It keeps me safe when I run my Windows 8 apps.
Those are lots of bad happenings.
Someone's trying to hack me.
I'm a genius hacker. I'm a hack eagle player. Own it.
Now I'm talking. Okay. Windows 8. It is made of pure awesome sauce.
Yankee, awesome sauce. I want you to pack my good player.
So I figure I've got until, what, October 17th when I can still use that. So I figure I had to use it this time. So that's what we want to talk about today, is how do we make the transition from thinking of app compat, which is plain and simple, how do I get off the old stuff altogether, right? The Windows XP I've got lying around, the IE6 I still run into from time to time, and I'm even seeing sort of IE8 becoming the next new legacy as the web starts progressing more quickly. We've duct taped this stuff all together, and we've got it all sort of past that let us move forward in the first place. How do we start going to a modern world altogether, given that starting point and giving an entire application portfolio? The good old days, quote unquote, are no longer with us. When we can think about, all right, we've got these discrete things, physical security, we put a door on the computer room and we have security, no problem. When we have books we can put together and all of this process, it's all based upon the idea of computing as a localized resource. Those are gone. And when we keep thinking in terms of how we did things on Windows XP, how we did things on Windows 2000, how we do things on Windows 7, and we refuse to change and evolve and move forward, we need to remind ourselves of the law of holes. When you realize you are in a hole, it's time to stop digging. And we want to think about modern apps and what that means and how we're going to get there gradually and by continuing to build new experiences. Experiences that can start to span form factors. We're no longer thinking about the PC as a desktop device with post-it notes all around the corner with all of your passwords on it, but instead thinking about all of the different things we can do, the ability to work from everywhere, the ability to start to have identity be something that is no longer just an individual password for every single site, but a unified concept. And what's more interesting, and I'm seeing people struggle with the most, is the concept of social and what it means to be social. And the world of social is one that people think, oh, it's Twitter, oh, it's Facebook, and all these things that have no meaning to the enterprise. And the real meaning to me of social is spanning complexity. There's some work by a researcher at MIT named Cesar Hidalgo that looks at the network of information within a society as a measure of the ability of that society to generate wealth. And it turns out to be really predictive. And what you find out is that as knowledge gets distributed across people, the society or the organization becomes more successful. And the same is true in the computing industry and within an enterprise. How many of you could build your own computer? And I'm not talking about I can go to the store and buy the parts and put them together. I'm talking about you get a pickaxe and go mine the rock, smelt the metal, build the wires, build the transistors, right? We can't do that. There's not one person who knows how to do all those things because the people who know how to get metal out of the ground don't know how to build transistors. And the people who know build transistors typically don't do the final assembly, certainly in bulk. Within the enterprise, we have this notion, and I see it all the time in App Compat, where we just want to know how does every app work. And the most successful organizations don't bother trying to know that. Instead, they look at how do I figure out who knows this and start crowdsourcing and let them tell me. Having the gradually expanding pilot is an enormously successful strategy for dealing with Compat versus I'm going to have one small team that looks at everything and certifies it. That's what social means to me, the ability to bring people together without requiring us to concentrate knowledge because it is beyond our abilities to understand all of the things that make our organizations tick. Our brains aren't big enough. It's often said that the last person who knew all of the knowledge on Earth was Leonardo da Vinci. That was hundreds of years ago. So it means a move away from the way we used to think about apps, where we had an application that sat on top of middleware, that sat on top of an OS, that sat on top of hardware, and we had people that managed every single piece of the puzzle. And this became wildly inflexible, and it didn't work very well. We look at changes in how we are expected to manage applications and the latency that we're allowed. Online transaction processing, we get on the order of microseconds rather than seconds. We talk about SLAs, we no longer talk about we'll get something within days. I used to work in market research. We did statistics. Anyone who's done statistics may be familiar with things like SAS or SPSS, and the way we used to do them was we would give them to a SAS or an SPS programmer, and they would have a couple of weeks to churn out results. Now we expect real-time analysis. And those shifts are fundamentally changing the way that we have to build software. Shifts in user expectations for responsiveness. When I touch a screen, I would immediately see stuff moving around. That's the expectation that has been set. If you've used some devices that seemed really cool just a few years ago, they don't seem so cool anymore because they don't snap to your finger the way that modern devices do. So these are the kinds of expectations that people are starting to have for data, for knowledge, and for responsiveness from their apps. As we think about apps, where it really comes down to begin with, is understanding what my canvas is, what I'm painting with. And I bring up the concept of app management because it is an area, I think, that is of huge opportunity universally. I've worked with a bunch of customers, in north of 300 at this point, dealing with migrations off of legacy platforms, Windows 2000, Windows XP, onto Windows 7, Windows 8, and most recently Windows 8.1. And almost universally, every single one had to start with, well, let's go figure out what we have. Let's go get our inventory. People don't know the building blocks they're working with. And if you don't know the building blocks you're working with, how can you build a plan to leverage those building blocks and keep them up to date? When I think about how to build out a ability to do platform transitions, I look at it as a four-step process. Number one, I've got some applications that absolutely positively will need to have full regression tests or some variant thereof. And then I look at the applications that I'm just going to have people use and let me know if there's any problems with them. Organic testing versus structured testing. And then I look at how do I better improve my application governance, because if I started with an inventory, I clearly have a long way to go in terms of managing those apps, because I don't even know what I have to begin with. And finally, I look at, am I really taking advantage of the platform? Because if you get all the way to some modern platform and you are still using old applications, here's an application I wrote back in 1999. Does that give me a modern experience? Right? This is the most common outcome, is a bunch of VB6 style applications that don't respond well to touch, that are not providing a contemporary experience. It's a bunch of boxes, it's a bunch of check boxes, and it doesn't really take advantage of the platform. This isn't going to be able to transition to multiple devices. This isn't going to be able to do anything more than it used to, and I can have this really fancy new operating system that I paid $100 for, that took me $100 to deploy, and doesn't really do anything differently than what it used to. In essence, I'm on a treadmill. When I'm done, I'm sweaty. I've expended a bunch of energy and a bunch of time, and I haven't actually gone anywhere. Going somewhere, I think, is important. So these are the kind of things that I like to think about when I think about how do I figure out what I have and where I'm going. Now, application management, software asset management, which is often called, is normally initially funded by looking at something like license management. That was the most common start that most people got. Why license management? Well, it's real simple. Around about 2008, we had a little bit of a financial problem in quite a few companies in the world. And they decided that since no one really had any money to buy new software, they were going to try and collect some more money by funding the software they hadn't paid for. And so the ability to figure out if I had actually paid for all of my licenses drove people to do a much better job of doing inventory. Then we start looking at evolving that into overall portfolio management. What do I have? Am I covering the bases? Am I investing strategically in what matters for my company? And the final frontier, one which some people are just now talking about, I had really one of the few conversations I've had on this just earlier today, how do I start building in quality certification so that it's no longer just if it compiles, it'll run in my organization, which is honestly the quality certification that most people begin with today, and moves instead to, we're going to have a minimum bar that you're going to have to meet if you want to run stuff in our organization. And that minimum bar really should be set based upon what's causing you pain. Can you name the issues that are causing you to have a higher help desk volume and lower productivity in your organization? And if so, can you put in some kind of metric that would let you detect that before the software ships? And if so, are you doing that? And if not, why not? This is the question to ask. And as we think about modernizing, the thing we need to do better is measure. I think we have a part in not doing a great job in this, we Microsoft, and I think customers also can do a better job. Here's an interesting statistic. So IE, sort of behind the face of it, right, IE 11 has 7 different ways it can render a web page and parse JavaScript. How many knew that? Handful of people, right? Basically, it's one face with sort of 7 children. I heard an analogy I'd never heard before today. I'm going to steal it ruthlessly, which is it's kind of like one of those Russian dolls, right? IE 11 has IE 10 inside of it, has IE 9 inside of it, has IE 8 inside of it, has IE 7 inside of it, has IE 5 inside of it. All of those things are in there. And when we look at what enterprise applications are built on today, IE 5 Quirks Mode, a 1999 implementation of web standards, not the best, by the way, represents 70% of enterprise web applications today. Another fascinating fact, which is even more startling to me, 12% of the top 5,000 public-facing web applications run in Quirks mode. 70% in the enterprise, 12% publicly running in Quirks. A really, really old implementation of web standards. Now, why is that a problem? Well, there's some potential benefits of moving forward. Oh, Go Network, that's awesome. And one of them is sheer raw performance. So I paid a visit to a customer in London, and we were talking about IE9, and so this was obviously a couple years ago. And in IE9, they said, oh, performance, all this stuff is really good. So a guy walks into the room with his laptop after one of the breaks. He says, you said IE9 had good performance. Here's an app on IE. Look how slow it is. Here's the same app on Firefox. Look how fast it is. Clearly, you're lying. And I said, okay, that's interesting. He's running it in compatibility view because it's an internal application and that's the default. And one of the things we'd never done is we'd never sort of put them side by side, at least that I had seen. So I ran SunSpider on all of the document modes that we have in IE, and I said, aha, it looks like we actually do terrific beating everybody when we're in our latest rendering mode, and when we drop to the two modes that incidentally are the default in the local intranet zone, all of a sudden we were 10 times slower. So if I move forward, then I get faster. There's a benefit from doing that. But I also need to know where I am running modern modes and where I am not. So it starts with understanding your starting point. We look at the applications that are built, typically something on the order of 50% of enterprise rich client applications, or thick client, or whatever you want to call them. Installed applications are written in Visual Basic 6.
Yeah.
So there are all kinds of motivations to start moving forward, right? Which is, you know, when I, as I start to evolve and manage and understand what I'm doing, I start to be able to better manage my risk, and that eventually has some really good business drivers, and we look at having some methodology to quickly assess, start looking at any of the things that terrify me as I find them, start looking at what's important and begin managing it, and just have this process designed that not to have this huge, heavy, consultant-laden, we'll come in and look at every single thing, because you know what? That's really hard to justify, but one that just says, let's start with knowledge and let's add to it. Let's identify your problems. When you find you've got a bunch of VB5, it's time to take action. When you find you've got a bunch of dependencies on Java 1.3, it's time to take action, because that I can justify. After I assess, I can look at the challenges I have in urgency, things that are end of life, that are already gone, that I didn't know I depended on. That we can go through and fix. We can think of the important ones and making sure I'm balancing my investments correctly against what is strategic and what matters to me as an organization. Think about increasing value and think about how I can better map those to my business goals. The boring, non-nerdy stuff that it turns out gets us money and funding. And the hardest conversations are the ones that take employee productivity into account. And I've had customers ask me flat out, great, if you're going to save me all this money, who am I going to fire to get it back? And I usually point to someone randomly in the room, and that works out pretty well so far. But we can start to better align our applications against what we would think matters, right? Right now, most of our investments are in things that are relatively low risk, keeping the lights on. We're not taking significant risks, which means we cannot realize significant gains. When we look at how we are investing in the stack, how much of your time is spent managing the client instead of building apps that solve business problems? Every single person who manages Windows desktops is doing nothing but adding to the infrastructure piece. And that's the transition that the industry is starting to go towards, is that that infrastructure stack, someone else can do that. That's becoming more and more commoditized, and I can start to invest more in the things that are differentiating and move away from sustaining technology as the default to innovating technology as the default. And I can really move away from systems of record into more systems of differentiation and systems of innovation. This is all kind of fluffy, touchy-feely kind of stuff, right? And I'm the nerd who normally gets up here and shows you debugger things. So it's kind of awkward for me too. But this stuff, it turns out, really matters. We need to come up with better solutions for driving organizations forward, and that starts with managing software better. This strategy is most successful, I found, when it's opt-in. When we take a grandfathering clause and we look at how important the app is in terms of its business value and how sensitive its data is, and start drawing some lines in the sand and determining where are we going to start investing first. It's also most successful when we don't expect things to last forever. Eventually, everything becomes irrelevant. And as soon as we start to get that sort of into our DNA, that it's no longer about, I want to find the next platform I can live for a decade on, because we were able to do that, right? When we transition from there to always up to date as a business as usual behavior, then we can start to become more effective, but only if we can keep the costs down. But this is something that I think goes counter to people's desires. I had a conversation last week where they said, Microsoft, I think you're doing a terrible job at App Compat. And as the App Compat guy, I was like, really? Go on. And they said, listen, the gold standard, we think, is IBM. So I said, go on. And they meant the mainframe. We've got an application here we've been running since 1970. That's the gold standard for us. And being born in 1970 myself, I said, that's a really good year to create something. But I'm starting to not run so well myself these days. So I don't know that we want to model things after me. But we have some platforms that have done pretty phenomenally well. Look at how long we've had VB6 around. VB6 has been alive longer than Buddy Holly lived. Longer than the Betamax lived. Longer than even the venerable Windows XP lived. And certainly if you're using Chrome or Firefox, you get a lot more lifespan out of VB6 than you do from a particular version of one of those. And it's actually kind of an interesting phenomenon that people don't necessarily understand all of the difference. We haven't been super clear. Well, we've tried to be super clear, but we haven't always succeeded. If you look at the support statement, here's a support statement for Visual Basic 6 on Windows Vista, Windows Server 2008, Windows 7, Windows 8, blah, blah, blah. We're committed to it just works. And here's all of this incredibly boring information that no one actually reads. Here's the stuff that actually matters. Visual Basic 6 will be supported through the lifespan of Windows 8, period, at least. Who knows what comes next? But that puts you through until 2022 for a product released in 1998. That's a pretty good run. What's that?
Thank God.
And we sort of talk about some of the details, and when we think about the details, what does it mean? Right? These are on the platform. These are supported that you have to distribute yourself. which means repackage them to drop them on there. So kind of a challenge for some folks is they really, hey, it doesn't work. Well, because you have to put those bits on the box during install time and you didn't used to. So now you do, but if you put them on there, we'll even service them for you. They're supported. Here are the ones that are unsupported, but they have updates. So all of the data access stuff has modern stuff. And then we've got some unsupported ones. Right, unsupported ones, incidentally, if you want to know the rationale behind those, that's not just, oh, those are unsupportable. This is what happens when you license code from somebody and don't get the source code. So I can give one example, the Threed DLL, which on here is the Threed 16, or Threed 32. Let me find this guy. Here we go, Threed 32. This guy right here, yeah, I had to do some research because we had a problem with that one. I'm like, well, why can we service that, right? Because it's blocking a deployment. Turns out we licensed that from a company that was acquired in 1998, and the acquiring company went bankrupt in 1999. No one knows where those guys are. They're unsupported because we don't have the source code, so if you call us with a problem, there is nothing we can do about it. And that's why we don't support them. It's not us trying to be jerks or sort of picking favorites and saying, yeah, we didn't like those as much. It's that we didn't write those. This is the danger of legacy technology. No one knows how to fix them anymore. Right? And this is the challenge we start to face across platforms. How many people coming out of college or coming out of college knowing VB6? Not a whole lot. What about that Quirks mode we just talked about? Quirks mode, an IE5 implementation, 1999. Do you know that a student coming out of college today hasn't had to look at IE5 since they were 8? Probably weren't writing a lot of code back then. I mean, these are some of the statistics that make you think, oh, maybe we need to start moving things forward. And that's going to have some impact. Eventually everything goes stale. Here's some interesting things on how things go stale. This is what happens when Java goes stale. This is from the Microsoft Security Response Center. This is the actual exploits, not potential exploits based on vulnerabilities. This is the number of people who are actually successfully attacking computers based on vulnerabilities. Guess who owns that blue line? Java. Round about the fourth quarter of 2010, all of a sudden, boom, through the roof, because the bad guys realized that enterprises love to pinpoint a very specific version of Java as their standard that doesn't move. And even Oracle disagrees with that. That's sort of the latest interesting round of bugs. I had someone come to me with an app compat bug saying, here's the problem we've got. We see this message come up. And I said, all right, you're going to have to actually show me the message if you want me to troubleshoot it, right? Debugging by email isn't the easiest thing, but it's a little bit easier if you give me a screenshot. And they sent me a screenshot, and it turns out that the guys who wrote Java put in a check. They'll go on and look and see if there's an updated version. And if so, they'll put up a big message box saying, your Java is out of date. Would you like to update it? A giant message box right in the middle of their screen. And they were sure it was Windows that was doing that, because it looked kind of Windowsy. And they're doing it because they're kind of getting a little bit of a black eye because the entirety of the U.S. government demanded that everyone turn off Java immediately in response to a zero-day bug they had. For very sensible reasons, but if you don't keep up to date, if you say, we're standardized on, I had this amazing conversation, 1.5 update 5 was what they were moving to from 1.3. And I said, that's interesting, because this was about a year ago, so I said 1.5 update 5 at that point was over a year old, out of date, so supported ended on all of the 1.5 line 1 year previously, at update 22, so they were 17 versions out of date on a version that was already a year out of support. Probably not the right way to modernize. So we need to think about it from a security perspective as well as from a capabilities perspective. Now, it doesn't always help that they sometimes change some of the functionality of the product when they update things, so that makes it harder sometimes. But the general way of thinking is to not just say, you know what, it's old, so therefore it's bad. Right? So we just went through saying old stuff has some problems, potentially. Being old doesn't make it bad. You know, software's not like milk. It doesn't spoil just because it's old. As I said, I've run into applications that have been running successfully since 1970. Some of the interesting ones I've run into, I found an application that runs in ambulances on Windows 95. It's disconnected, right? And the reason why they do that is because in the US, if you are in the healthcare industry, you have to go through a process called certification. And that certification process is really expensive, on the order of $1 million an app. Right, validation, sorry, it's not certified, it's validation, I think is the actual term. And so they carried on running it because it wasn't worth $1 million to them to update it. There's an application running in a very large public school system that is currently running on DOS 2.0 on an IBM PC. Doesn't work in DOS 3 or anything more current. And they have an actual IBM PC, the one with the clackety-clack keyboard, running in a closet. They lock up, and every single year they go in, they cross their fingers, they flick that giant orange switch, and they hope for the best, and so far it's been working. They don't have the source code. They just have a memory dump of what this thing looks like so that if one year it doesn't boot up, they're going to pay someone a whole lot of money to read that memory dump and interpret it and rewrite the application. But until they have to, they're not going to pay it. Software doesn't go bad. But software is a work of engineering. And as a work of engineering, it's designed to last for a certain amount of time. And we need to be mindful of what that amount of time is. For example, I took these pictures from the World's Fair in 1904 in St. Louis. I happened to go to school there, so that's why I happened to pick that particular World's Fair. What they had done was they wanted to recreate classic Greek architecture. But classic Greek architecture turns out to be rather expensive. So you look at the Parthenon, that thing has lasted for thousands of years. That's a great work of engineering, designed to last a long time. They had to last for 1 year, so they didn't build it out of marble. They built it out of plaster of Paris and hemp. I like to point that out because I very seldom get to use the word hemp in my public presentations. But as a result, they had to patch the thing periodically throughout the course of the year. It's a work of engineering. It's a work of design. And they had to plan for that. The same is true of software. It's a work of engineering designed to be maintainable for a certain amount of time. And we need to be mindful of how much time it was designed to last for, rather than expecting that to be infinity. Right? I worked with one customer on an application. They said, this application, we expected it to be used for 3 years. We've been using it so far 12. And we expect probably 12 more we'll be able to get rid of it. And it was never designed for that. Think about how you design something to last for years and years and years. Do you know how much time we spent writing the actual code for Windows 7? 3 months. It was a 3-year cycle. The rest of that was bug fixes and maintainability. And that's the kind of investment it takes to make something designed to last there, not just, oh, I got it to compile, let's ship it and hope it lasts for 12 years, which is the average lifespan of an application. So the strategy that we recommend is the grandfather strategy, one that says, by default, keep everything working. Let's start with that. Then let's look at this whole portfolio, what I've got, and look at, well, if I'm going to do a significant upgrade, right, if it's for the web, let's at least get to fairly sensible web standards, right? Maybe not the latest. I don't need to make it an HTML5 application, but can I make it not quirky? And can I make it lay out in any modern browser correctly? And if I'm taking in new applications, can I start to say, you know what, my new stuff should be built on new technology. I don't want to build new applications on old technology. This is hard. We see people all the time, if I have to maintain VB6 applications, I have to keep VB6 running somewhere. Incidentally, you can get VB6 running on 8.1. Not that I recommend it. But it runs. Oh, look at this. Yeah, go ahead and remove that. I don't know what that is. There we go. I didn't say it was perfect. I'm saying it works. Right? You can. I could debug that. This is not an AFCompat session, or I would debug it. It would be one of those unplanned debugging demos. You get it out there, right? You can put it on their machines, right? Whether it's a physical machine or a virtual machine or whatever you do. The problem is, once it's on there, people tend to build more stuff with it because it's comfortable, it's familiar. I worked with one organization. It was not in your country, so you shouldn't feel ashamed. My country should. It was in mine. They had purchased Visual Basic 3 a while ago and never saw a reason to update it. They were not professional developers. They did not have any awareness of application life cycles or developer tools life cycles. They figured it was good, I don't know, forever. And they were still building brand new stuff today because they owned it. They had it installed. The new one costs money. They didn't like spending money, and so they were generating brand new VB3 apps, which rather inconveniently all happened to be 16-bit. Incidentally, that is actually the biggest challenge we see with Install Shield. And so Flexera Software, the guys who make Install Shield, guys and girls, they are located in Schaumburg, Illinois, which is two towns south of where I live. So I meet them up with them for lunch probably twice a year or so. And they said that's our biggest problem is that any version of Install Shield gets the job done. So people really don't have to buy a new one, and often don't. So I run into a whole bunch of 16-bit installers because they just haven't bought a new version of Install Shield since the early 90s. Because it still gets the job done today until such time as they go to 64-bit Windows. And then suddenly it becomes a really big problem. So grandfathering works well as a beginning strategy. But then making sure you introduce new apps even though you have the capability to build old ones, that's the hard part. And that's where having quality criteria and having a quality bar comes into play. The next question, and one that we often haven't answered super well, is why should I in the first place? What's the value? The typical enterprise app is honestly some variation on put a bunch of boxes on the screen with data that I fetch from a database. And then do something to that data. Enter it. So what can I not do in 2001 technology that I need now? What's the difference? And this is the conversation to have. Part of it is just end of support. We see, hey, I got to move off of .NET 1.1. .NET 1.1 is coming to end of life soon. And oh, by the way, we didn't ever have it on Windows 7. VB6, the development environment, support's been gone for a long time because it's 15 years old. SQL Server 2000, end of support is coming soon. Looks like we extended that one. The cost of maintenance is going up over time, and there are all kinds of financial reasons from a support perspective and from a responsiveness perspective. But to me, the more interesting thing is the ability to take advantage of what the platform is doing. Back when we first started coming out with PC-based applications, the innovation was happening on the platform side. Every single new release brought something tasty, right? This is back in the days when we started off with no TCP/IP stack. And then we had one, so you didn't have to buy one anymore. And if you could keep up, you got that for free. And around about 2000, they just inverted. And all of a sudden, the platform wasn't doing a whole lot. You started getting things like coalescing timers. How many of you ever heard of that? The ability, yeah, a couple of nerds. The ability to, hey, I got all the love for nerds, right? But it really didn't impact your ability to write apps until you started thinking about battery life. Coalescing timer says, if I'm going to have you wake up every so often, if I've got a tolerance, I can have you start lining up, which means my CPUs wake up less often and I start to have less battery life. And that's really interesting if I'm paying the electricity bill, if I can measure that, which, by the way, I can't. Right? I could if I worked really, really hard, but the cost of measurement ended up being higher than the value of knowing and being persuasive, so therefore people didn't measure, and therefore they couldn't build a persuasive case to do that. But those are the kinds of innovations that happened, things that were really under the scenes that didn't impact my ability to write apps. So for about 10 years, you could basically change almost nothing and still be really modern. And as a result of this 10 years where things weren't changing as much, what did people do with their apps? They made them bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and these giant Taj Mahal apps all bolted together from all these technologies in this huge, huge megalith. I worked with a customer that had a 7-year Siebel customization project. 7 years, one app. When they were done, they were already out of date and could not afford to move forward. And then all of a sudden, lately, they've reversed. What happens on the web? HTML5 can do all kinds of stuff it could never do before. Now I can build an app that has the same functionality I used to need to write in C++ to do, using nothing but HTML. I can build touch-based experiences without writing hardly any code. All of a sudden, the platform's really moving. I'm getting new platforms once a year, sometimes even more often, doing really interesting things, but I've got these giant megaliths that are not prepared to move. That's the challenge. So I have this notion that I need to build a case for why I need to build those, right? Modern apps, they're faster. We looked at the web experience. The same is true in other worlds as well. I can start to build things that are more performant. I can have fewer dependencies. And this, to me, in the web particularly, is where the really big challenges are. But I see it a little bit on the Windows side, too. It's not that third parties are bad, because they're not. Third parties are fantastic. It's when you require multiple third parties to have to cooperate that things get in trouble. Why? Because they love to play the finger-pointing game every time something goes wrong, and they're in a mixed ecosystem. Hey, this thing broke. I think it's Flash's problem. Oh, no, that's the new IE. Okay, call Microsoft. Nope, that's Flash. Call Adobe. Call Adobe. Microsoft says it's you. Oh, no, definitely Microsoft. How many times has that happened? Right, when you start having to cooperate, even within vendors, right? I had a really interesting meeting last week where we had 5 different vendors. So I was in a place where the company required competitive bidding for every single app dev project they did. And as a result, they had multiple vendors who they all brought together to talk about how do we start modernizing the web and how do we deal with compatibility and modernization and all these other things, all in the room at the same time. Turns out, they don't get along very well. Because they all want each other's business. Right? And the ability to do more things with just the raw platform without having to have all these people cooperate has tremendous business value. Thinking about providing new user experiences has value. And the biggest one is they're cheaper and they're easier to maintain. Here's an interesting take on business value that I've used in some conversations. If I'm talking about the web, HTML5, it happens to be a very terse technology. Let's walk through it. Here is an old HTML4 header. Doesn't really do much, right? Just says, hello world. But let's see what happens as we gradually modernize this to be standards compliant HTML5. Let's start with that doc type. Wow, that sucker's really long. Let's just say it's HTML. All right. What about that HTML declaration? That's pretty long, too. Let's just say it's HTML and it's in English. All right, let's carry on forward. We've got that content type saying the character set is UTF-8 encoded. Let's just say meta tag. And, oh, there's that link to that style sheet. Let's go ahead and shorten that and just say here it is. And suddenly we've got a final page that's a whole lot shorter than what we started with. That's a difference of 412 characters versus 188. Why does that matter? Well, we have to do some math. 422 minus 188, That's a difference of 234 bytes every single time that page is requested. Now, let's say we have a web page that we end up accessing. I don't know if it's a web application that's used in my call center. They're using it all day long. Let's say for 8 hours a day, and they go through and hit it, say, how many times an hour? A couple hundred, 200 times an hour per user. And let's say I've got a company with 20,000 users. So I'm going to end up saving that many bytes of data per day wasted with useless characters going over my network on an app. And if I look at, all right, it's this many bytes, so this many kilobytes and this many megabytes and this many gigabytes, 6.9 gigabytes of data each and every day wasted on HTML that doesn't help me do anything better. There's some value in this boring stuff when you start dealing with large numbers. We looked at some of the value savings we saw in Windows 7 all up, and we had one customer where they cost justified their deployment of Windows 7 by literally looking at the power consumption changes, and they measured it. This is how much power we sucked out of the wall when we had this device running XP. This is how much power we sucked out of the wall when the same device was running Windows 7. Multiply it by number of devices, and there we have it. We've just paid for our project. These kind of little things add up. This, incidentally, is the reason why we changed the user agent string, starting with IE9, to be a whole lot shorter. We no longer listed, hey, you've got these .NET frameworks installed, and we've got all these other things, all those little tokens that threw on there. We got rid of them because they just wasted bandwidth. Every single web request, you've got all of this bandwidth being wasted on that, and that adds up over time when you start dealing with a big organization and lots of people. You can cost justify a large project in a lot of cases by looking at how does that change how much data gets put through. But we do have to convince the business, because I had conversations the past 2 weeks with customers, and all of them were like, listen, I see no reason why I should move forward from what I got. Because boxes showing data from a database look just as good in HTML4 as they do in HTML5. So that's the why. I think that's an important conversation. I think the next question is the how. How on earth do I go about doing it? And when we look at putting together modernization, there are really sort of three different ways to go about doing it, each of which has a very different value. We can modernize as is. Right? Take the same code, run it through something that will take your VB6 and spit out VB.NET. There are products that do that. They do a pretty good job. I usually hand tune them at the end, but it gives you a good starting point. We can redesign it, which says, let's take what we have, let's modernize it, and let's sort of recomponentize it. Or, better still, let's re-envision it. Are we building the right thing? Should we build something else for that environment? And I think the most successful strategy I've seen is ones that look at hitting particular targeted scenarios. So rather than rebuild an entire app, particularly if it's one of those big app Taj Mahal things, think about a scenario and solving that. I think a great example to look at is what have we done with Office? That's our megalith. What's the first thing we did? Well, we tried to get Touch to work a whole lot better because Touch didn't work real well. If you ever tried using Office 2010 on a touchscreen, unless you had a low-resolution screen, it wasn't so fun. So we said, hey, there's a touch mode. We'll kind of spread everything out to make it easier to use. That's a bit of a redesign. Not a big one, right? It certainly wasn't re-envisioning it, but it's redesigning it to better accommodate that scenario. The re-envisioning part is what we've been gradually trickling out in terms of what comes out for a given platform. So we look at Windows 8 apps, we have OneNote that comes as a Windows 8 app, which is completely designed for that experience. we leveraged as much existing code as we could. So therefore, when they wrote it in C++. So they could take their existing code and just bring it into the project and not have to redo the whole thing. See the same thing in Link. Let's reuse as much of the existing code as we can, and let's build a new front end. And this notion of building an API layer on top of what we're doing and then thinking about the experience and crafting it. You know, OneNote for Windows 8 or OneNote for the phone is not designed to replace absolutely everything that you could do in OneNote on the PC, in the desktop mode. It's not, and that's okay. It's designed to really fulfill that experience well and fulfill that scenario. When we think about pushing through source code, the process that we generally use is, you know, let's do analysis, let's identify integration points, let's look at third-party code, let's figure out what we need to replace, what we need to bring in, and churn it through, go through testing, do UAT, and just iteratively go through, rebuild the platform, reimagine it, but leverage as much of the existing stuff that we can, because the code you already have is an incredibly valuable asset that you don't want to throw away. Why did Netscape lose the race? By arguably doing the dumbest thing a browser maker could have done and throw away over a decade worth of bug fixes. They thought they were getting rid of the spaghetti code. They were also getting rid of all the bug fixes. So the same bugs came back again. Right? We were happy to have them do that. Let's not kid ourselves, right? We were like, hey, that was actually a pretty good idea, guys. Worked really well for us. But you need to leverage these investments that you've already made and get the most bang for your buck. When we think about this process, it's all part of an iterative planning routine that looks at what's your strategy, how are you handling your portfolio, what have you got, do you have an assessment, where does it fit? And we go through a build phase, right? And we leverage the, you know, the iterative, you know, MSF, where we, you know, have, you know, some combination of either waterfall or agile, whatever technology we're using. We migrate as much existing code as we can. We build as much new code as is appropriate to hit the scenario. We deploy, we measure, we monitor, we add instrumentation. DevOps has sort of been the big thing lately, which is how do we make these things more manageable? How do we bring in more data and make it more actionable and iteratively do that? We within Microsoft do it using a factory model wherever we can. So we are able to, you know, leverage a lot of offshore resources to do some building and some of the code conversion in particular. Really great spot for us to do that. I know there are other people who do it on-premise. We do a mixture thereof. But it's this process that really works well. Reusing the existing code being primary. How do we keep that investment? And how do we leverage that over time? If you've got a Windows 8 app, do you have to rewrite everything from scratch? And I think some of the most successful Windows 8 apps are ones that don't. That if you have desktop pieces, that you can start using them and build that API layer on top of it. Incidentally, I know that a lot of people are leaving now. A lot of people have dinner plans starting at 7:15, 7:30, and I'm cool with that. Right? So if you guys are ready to go, I'm not going to feel offended because I know you got dinner plans. I'm also going to be delighted if you stay. Anyway, how do we handle that? Right? So on the OneNote side, we had a team of, I think, 10 developers working for a year and a half building the OneNote immersive app experience, which is a pretty big group of folks. But in other examples, we had to move much more quickly and leverage more existing code. A great case study we have is Emirates, which is a public, so I can actually talk about them and probably not get into too much trouble, although Michael's sitting in the front row, he'll correct me if I color outside of the lines, if you will. They have an app that's run on all of their airplanes on a tablet. And we featured them during the launch, we talked all about it. That app is talking to a desktop app on the same device. And so what they ran into was a challenge. which is we really designed the sandbox in Windows 8 apps to keep you from talking to desktop apps. I have a session that sort of talks all about what that sandbox is called Windows 8 Security Internals, which I ran here last year, which is why it's not here this year, because they don't do things twice here. But it's recorded, so you can go and see it, that talks about the sandbox. In essence, these things get put into an app container. App containers, I can show you what that looks like. See, now we'll get nerdy again. Now it's more of a Chris Jackson session. If I look into what app containers do, let's find one. Oh, here's one. Here's one in an app container. An app container means it's going to have in its security token a SID that basically says, I am an app container. It is unique to that particular application. This SID happens to be generated based on a unique hash of the name of the app, which means you've got to enforce some uniqueness, and that's all part of the sort of overall Windows 8 app management strategy. But access checks, look for that. If you have an app container SID, the access check will make sure that your app container is allowed to get there, which sort of blocks you from getting to typical desktop resources. So what happens if you want to talk to desktop resources and you're inside of an app container? What can you do? You got two choices. Number one, you can poke a hole and just grant access to that app container because that app container SID is knowable. Or number two, you can do a loopback for a web call, which is much more designed, you know, what the API is designed for, except for you're on the same machine, which technically puts you in violation of the Windows Store guidelines. But if you're sidelining, you don't need to worry about the Windows Store guidelines. So the question is, which of the two paths do you want to pick? Because both technically are against Windows Store guidelines, but you're not putting it into the store. My personal preference is the web loopback. We are working on getting much more clarity in what is okay in a sideloaded environment. But either way, you can leverage that. And I think that is an important part of the strategy is looping back and leveraging your desktop code. If you have an HTML app, simply updating to modern standards starts putting you on top of more devices. And anytime you've got the sort of end tier, this middleware, or even desktop, putting some kind of web interface in front of it starts to expose you to those modern scenarios, whether it's local, whether it's remote, as you start to then think about, then, does this belong on this machine? Or is it on this machine for convenience sake? Typically, we often see it's because of convenience sake. The developer said, hey, I got VB6, I'll put it all right here, because I get that. It's a single solid thing. Well, it may make sense to move some of that up into a quote-unquote cloud. And now suddenly it seems to work a whole lot better in these modern paradigms, but it's still the same code. And that API layer is what allows me to get there. So I can start moving it towards this design where we have this stateless web that grabs these requests, sticks them in a queue, they get pulled off by worker processes, the answer goes back in the queue and fed back to the application, and this whole model starts to play through because I've put this front end and gradually evolved it without a pure and simple rewrite of everything that I've done to build towards these app models. It's really not that drastically different from what we've done before. End here. I see end tiers there. It's got a different name now. We've learned more about the architecture, so we rebranded, but the ideas are often very similar. The hardest part is getting to asynchronous. Asynchronous code, multi-threaded code, is still really hard to write. And people do a terrible job of it. But that, to me, is the big thing to do in terms of design is getting to the point where you have the ability to respond to things asynchronously. We start thinking about designing to be more maintainable. I think that's a challenge, right? How do we keep a pulse on what's happening as we start to pull these applications apart and provide diagnostic output on how well am I running? And we start to think about how do we design these applications to feel modern. And this, when we start having this conversation of the modern, the natural user interface, right, this gets almost humorous because the first thing we do is we default to some conversation about, hey, moves like people do. We've got Kinect for Windows, and there are a couple scenarios where that works. I don't know about you, but my most common application that I use is probably my debugger. Second to that, probably Visual Studio, and I do a lot of my work on airplanes. And turns out the Kinect user experience does not work so well on an airplane. Instead, we need to be mindful of, like, hey, what is the right experience for that application? How do we have the application give us insight, be able to adapt, right? There are all kinds of design philosophies there. To me, the big thing is understanding how we can start to hit scenarios as they matter with subtle little things. And we always look at the consumer side, they demo easier, they're sexier, but I think there are all kinds of interesting things you can do in the enterprise that really work well, even in form factors you've already got. This was a great example I saw from a customer that ran a call center where their differentiating factor was customer service. So what they wanted to do was get as much information about the customer out there as they possibly can and put it all together and make it really easy for their customer service reps to give a terrific experience. The Windows 7, I don't even got to go to Windows 8 for this, the Windows 7 taskbar provides APIs that allow you to start grouping applications together. That's how Internet Explorer, despite having multiple processes running simultaneously, is able to group into a single taskbar item all of the Internet Explorer windows that are living there. They leverage that taskbar customizability. The customer saw that and said, aha, you may group it together by app. I don't think about apps. I happen to have multiple apps as a legacy of how things became built. But I think about customers. So I'm going to put together under one icon all of the information about this one customer. So if I click this one customer's button, all of his stuff comes up. And if I minimize it, I can make all of that customer stuff go down and then bring the next customer, have all of her stuff come up or go down and group them together that way. That's an experience that's personalized for that device that's modeled after how they run their business. I saw an application that was specifically designed for people who were out doing inspections of buildings. You're inspecting a building. PCs, even netbooks, are not a terribly good form factor for that. So they can start to build an experience that is designed for people with giant fingers because they're building inspectors, right? Out there doing things quickly, taking pictures, incorporating that all on a single device. These are the kind of business scenarios that we imagine. And as we start thinking about multiple devices and making new experiences, the number one inhibitor to that I found is I have such a highly customized environment because my security guys are really, really freaking bored that it makes it impossible to start entering new scenarios because they don't have mappings for all of those extreme customizations. It's a real problem that's happening more and more often. So the caution I would give when you think about hitting everywhere is, am I dependent upon a highly customized situation? Here's the problem with that. In the world of IE alone, not the rest of Windows, just the IE part, this is the actual number of different permutations of group policies in IE. This is the number of molecules in the observable universe, by way of comparison. Turns out we don't have this many test cases, so we have lots and lots of people who are in completely unknown situations because no one on the planet has ever before or will ever again tune that configuration, making it really hard for them to start expecting that configuration to exist on some other device. We also look at building experiences that are designed to give me insight into the business and express that insight and that really deliver an experience designed to leverage group knowledge that moves away from the notion of having to have a long instruction manual, that starts to bring that knowledge and information and social behavior and understand user intent and bring it forward. That instruments, that analyzes, that takes control of what's happening and incorporates that. And having entire processes designed to profile, to track, right? This is from a consumer example. We need to start thinking about more enterprise examples. And I will freely admit, we don't do a great enough job of giving enterprise level examples of this kind of thing because it's easier to demo consumer stuff. But how do I gather insight from what I'm doing and make it easier for customer service reps to understand what the most frequently asked questions are and start answering them earlier on so I don't have to make you go searching as often? That's useful information. But to me, as I said before, solving the scenario really, really well is much better than building the entirety of an app and waiting until you have the coverage. Now, this is a challenge, right? When you think about application proliferation, right? How many of you have started new projects? You're like, all right, well, we didn't quite replace all of the functionality of the old app, so we have the new app and the old app too, and the app before that, and the app before that. And eventually, we never get rid of anything. But if the better I solve the scenario, if there is no reason to use the other bits, then eventually we can get rid of them. And we have a great experience when I'm in that scenario. And the caution I always give also is I think in general, we tend to ignore externalities. There's a really interesting research paper that talks about from the security perspective, which is called So Long and No Thanks for All the Fish, The Rational Rejection of Security Guidance by Users, and it's based upon all of the externalities that we place out there. Making a security decision has no cost, except for every single user gets inconvenienced all the time. Right? Think about UAC configuration. I can do two things. I can make you say yes, or I can make you type your password. Seems more secure to make you type your password in some people's eyes, so I just make every single user type their password every single time. Okay, well, that has a cost because those people are then not working when they're typing their password for the nth time. And we see this in all kinds of things. Like, hey, I want to have a strategy that's a dual browser strategy that lets me use HTML5 today while keeping my beloved IE8 for a while longer. Great, except for my end users have to pick the right browser every time. And if they navigate to the wrong site, they'll have a negative experience, and so now I've got to train them. And that has a cost. It's just not borne by me, central IT. It's borne by the users. It's an externality. I need to be aware of that. What is my app, and am I focused on not adding cost and burden to my user base as a part of that? All up, I think the opportunity before us is to not only lead the transformation from software into services, but to lead the transformation from software into experiences, not one at a time, but from a portfolio-wide perspective. And I know that over the course of the past 71 minutes, I've touched upon a little bit of dev, a little bit of management, a little bit of enterprise architecture, and not really gone deep in everything. This is kind of a survey conversation, but I think as we continue to move forward, we all need to get more cross-discipline. I fought it. I'm a nerd. I come from an app dev background, and I got into this whole app compat space, and suddenly I'm in the middle of deployment projects with a bunch of, you know, IT administrators who I didn't understand. But this ability to span the barriers, that to me is what's differentiating today. So with that, you can win a sculpt mouse and read stuff, but I'd like to thank you all for coming, hanging out late, eating some pies, and hope you have a great rest of your tech ed. Any questions, comments, pies, beer? Does anyone have beer? Because that would be fantastic. Yeah, where's the party? No, the party I'm crashing tonight. Where's that?